From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Close to 60,000 unaccompanied minors have been detained along the border since October 1st, most from areas of gang violence and poverty in Central America. Earlier this month, President Obama asked for $3.7 billion in emergency funds, but Republicans in Congress are balking. This hour, On Point, a roundtable of Latinos in America on how the U.S. should respond. Joining me now from Miami is Alan Gomez. He covers the story for USA Today, and his own parents came from Cuba. Welcome, Alan, to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Alan, catch our listeners up, first of all, on the actual state of the crisis. There have been some reports, including in my newspaper, The New York Times, that the flow has slowed, which suggests that some of the signals that the United States and President Obama have sent may have been getting through. Has the problem diminished, in fact?
I mean, that's what the initial numbers are saying. Those numbers came from the White House just the other day. And, you know, so it's a little too early to tell if this is just a quick snapshot, a quick decline, and it's going to kind of continue over the next few months, or if that's going to be the trend and it's going to start slowing down. So it's a little early to tell so far. As you mentioned, there's been over 43,000 kids from Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador who've come in the last since October. And that's what we're focused on right here. That's why everybody's responding to this crisis right now. And yeah, there's been a quick dip right now, but not sure if that's going to be long lasting.
So nobody should jump to the conclusion that this problem is solving itself.
Absolutely not. I mean, it's even at the numbers they're seeing right now, about 150 of these kids being caught a day. That's down from about 350 a day just a couple of weeks ago. But 150 is still a significant amount and is still enough to overflow those Border Patrol stations down at the border.
What is the status of the emergency funds that the president has requested? And when do we expect a resolution on that?
That's a great question. But as you can expect, I mean, we've gotten two very different proposals and responses to the White House request from the Senate and the House. The Senate introduced their sort of answer to this in the last couple of days. It lowers the president's request. He had asked for $3.7 billion. Roughly half of that would go to house these kids and care for them while they're in U.S. custody. The other half would go to more border security, more judges, more prosecutors to speed up their deportations. What we saw in the Senate, they approved, they're looking for about $2.7 billion. So they're reducing that number overall. And the House side, not exactly sure. They're just putting this out this morning. Not exactly sure what their price tag is just yet. But theirs is more focused on sending in the National Guard, adding more of those judges, adding more security, and implementing a broader border security bill to kind of take it a step further and try to get a little bit more control of that border.
What is the role of the National Guard? We've seen, you mentioned the Republican bill. Governor Perry of Texas has said he's going to mobilize National Guard troops. Given the fact that these are kids who legally are turning themselves in and are allowed to stay pending legal review, what's the role of the National Guard?
Well, historically, the role, whenever we've used the National Guard along the border, it's been to basically just kind of help out Border Patrol. 2006 was the last major deployment of National Guard to the border. President Bush at the time ordered, it was about 6,000 of them for 2 years along the entire border. And what they did primarily was kind of backup roles. They were kind of looking through observational posts along the border. They were flying surveillance flights. They were building pieces of the wall. And of the border wall. And so what that does is free up Border Patrol agents to be on the ground, to be on the border, to be, you know, doing their job. And so what Governor Perry is calling for is to do basically just that. They're not going to be the ones out there actually catching these folks along the border. But as you say, there's a very big difference in this flood of immigrants than there has been in the past. Before, the challenge was catching them. They were going through deserts. They were going through mountains. They were making it. They were trying to go. They were trying as best they could to evade federal authorities. What we're seeing now is these kids, the smugglers aren't even crossing the border in many instances. They're sending them along, telling them where to go, saying, as soon as you find a Border Patrol agent, sit down, present yourself.
But the kids are seeking out law enforcement.
Exactly. These coyotes, as they're called, the smugglers that kind of take them along, usually they travel with them all the way into the United States until they get to a safe point and they can kind of assimilate into the country. What they're doing now in a lot of cases is kind of getting them to the border, but then saying, all right, go over there, hang a left, and you're going to see a couple of Border Patrol agents come up at some point, present yourself to them. Because of the federal laws that govern how we handle kids from Central American countries, they go and they sit down and present themselves, knowing that they're going to be taken into custody and they're going to be taken care of.
Well, now you mentioned that federal law. Of course, the law signed at the end of the Bush administration said the Central American kids would not be immediately sent back. They would go through this legal process. The administration seems to acknowledge that this flood is an unintended consequence of that law, and yet they seem to be resisting Republican attempts to change that law. Why is the White House resisting that?
Well, I mean, that's been interesting to follow how that's worked out. A couple of weeks ago, when the president first proposed his budget request, that $3.7 billion we've been talking about, at the time, his aides were the one who raised the issue. They were the ones saying, look, because of that 2008 law, which requires that these kids that come from countries like Central America, that they be taken in, that they be cared for by the Department of Health and Human Services, that they get legal services, that they get all sorts of assistance, all these protections to make sure we're not sending them back into a rough situation. So it was the White House that first kind of brought this up. But then they immediately started getting just some really sharp blowback from Democrats all around Washington. Senator Patrick Leahy, who's one of the ones who kind of co-authored that back when it came out, said he would fight tooth and nail against it. They complain about the loss of due process rights for these kids.
That's changed their view.
That's what it looks like, because at first they were talking about it, and all of a sudden they are absolutely not talking about it, and Democrats on the Hill are fighting very hard to keep that out of any kind of change that Congress comes up with.
Alan Gomez, wait right there. I want to bring into our discussion from Culver City, California, Fermin Vasquez. He grew up in El Salvador. His mother came to the United States in 1991. He came in 1999 as an unaccompanied minor, crossing the Mexico-California border. He met his mother in San Diego, now legal resident in the process of applying for citizenship. Graduate of Cal State Los Angeles, communication specialist at the Community Coalition, which works in neighborhoods in South L.A. Fermin, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Fermin, could you just walk through your own story, since it so closely resembles that of these children now coming forward? How did you get to the border? Was it coyotes that Alan was just discussing that took you there? And talk about your journey.
Yes, so my mom came here in 1991 from El Salvador, and she came in search of a better life, like many that come here. And the reason why she came is because there was a civil war going on in El Salvador in the 1980s. The civil war lasted about 12 years, and hundreds of people were killed. 80,000 people were killed during that period of time. And our family was affected by that. So she decided to come to the U.S. in search of a better life and to provide a better future for herself and her children. She came here with nothing but a suitcase full of dreams. She started working hard here. She cleaned houses for people, and you know, she raised enough money so that I can come here about 8 years later. And
just to clarify, Fermin, she came without any other family, just by herself, not with kids,
yes,
not with
by
spouse.
Herself. She did not. She knew a friend of a friend, and yeah, no family here.
Okay, so then how old were you when you decided that it was the right time to try to join her?
I was 11 years old. I didn't decide. I was brought here. I wanted to be reunited with my mother. And I took that journey. We traveled, we walked, we took buses. We actually took a plane from Southern Mexico to Central Mexico.
Did you pay a coyote for that? And how much did it cost?
My mom paid someone, yes, I think it was about $5,000. And I crossed in a van. And since then, I've been here. I learned English. I went to school. And you know, I'm here, I pay taxes, and I'm about to become a citizen.
You crossed in a van across the border in San Diego?
Yes.
No problem? No law enforcement intervention?
No, they told us, they pretty much told us to pretend to fall asleep, and they taught us some English words if anything were to happen. So that's how I came here.
Interesting. And tell me what you see that is different about what these young children who are coming up from Central America are experiencing.
Well, I see myself in these children, and they are children. They're our children. And I see that they're coming for some of the very same reasons that my family came here, because of violence in Central America, because of the drug wars that are happening. And you know, they are economic refugees, and that's how we should look at them. And I think, you know, they are not a threat to our country, as some people have suggested. They are children, and we should treat them as such.
We're talking with Alan Gomez, a Cuban-American who's immigration reporter for USA Today, and also with Fermin Vasquez. He came to the United States as an unaccompanied minor himself in 1999 from El Salvador at age 11 and is in the process of applying for U.S. citizenship. He's a communications specialist at the Community Coalition, which works to improve schools and create safe neighborhoods in South Los Angeles. And joining me now from Washington is Jose Cardenas. His parents came to the United States from Colombia. He's an associate at the consulting firm Vision Americas. He served in the State Department, the National Security Council under George W. Bush, and the U.S. Agency for International Development, where he was acting assistant administrator for Latin America and the Caribbean. Jose, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, John.
Jose, immigration is an issue where President George W. Bush and Barack Obama have actually had a substantial amount of agreement. How would you, even though the Republican Party in the last few years has changed the way it views the issue, how do you assess President Obama's handling of immigration more broadly and this crisis in particular?
Well, I do believe that most Americans that follow public affairs closely obviously believe that that our country is in dire need of broad immigration reform. The current system is just so contradictory, it is so confusing, and it has resulted in so many, as we said, unintended consequences. I think where the Obama administration is at fault is not understanding how its unilateral actions and its rhetoric have been received abroad. And this has no doubt been exacerbated by human smuggling rings who have mischaracterized or recast the administration's actions to vulnerable populations in Central America, that if you are intending to come to the United States, then now is the time.
But now, Jose, just let me stop you for 1 second. Wasn't the 2008 law signed by your former boss, George W. Bush? Isn't that
correct?
What sent the message?
Well, that is one of the great mysteries to me as to why anybody is invoking that 2008 law. The 2008 law deals with victims of human trafficking. What is going on in the border, what has created the crisis, is not human trafficking but human smuggling. Two very different activities. In trafficking, you have people being taken from their homes against their will and forced into nefarious activities such as slavery, such as prostitution. Human smuggling is an act in which people willingly involve themselves in. Nobody is forcing anyone from Central America in the broad number of cases to want to immigrate to the United States. So it is a mystery to me why everybody is invoking that 2008 law. Perhaps another guest can enlighten me on that issue.
Republicans are calling for the law to be changed.
Exactly. It's both sides.
Mm-hmm.
Both sides are repeatedly vectoring in on that law. And even reading reports from the Congressional Research Service over the last few days about the 2008 law and its applicability to the current crisis raises questions. That's one part of the problem. We also have push factors, and that is another area. The situation in Central America has been the security situation has been in decline for a number of years now, and that operates as the push factor for causing people to make very difficult decisions about leaving their homes. And so that is another area that the administration must spend more time analyzing and figuring out how we can work with these governments in the region to stabilize the domestic situations in these countries that are, frankly, making it so intolerable.
I want to give our listeners a sense of the emotions that this has roiled within our country as some of these unaccompanied children have come across. Here's the sound of some protesters outside a processing center in California on June the 24th. They prevented a bus full of detained women and children from reaching the processing center. Now, that's a pretty significant level of anger and emotion coming out. And one of the things the political system has to do is try to interpret what that means. Where is the resistance in the United States coming from? I want to go to the calls. We've got listeners beginning to light up our phone lines. Artie is on the line from Boston, Massachusetts. Artie, welcome to the show, and go ahead.
Hi, John. How you doing today?
Good.
I think what the main thing that everybody's missing, the reason why everybody's so upset, is there's some people that are understanding how deep this really goes. And the problem is that when the borders are open, it's not about race. Nobody hates the people that are coming here, but we know there's a larger agenda for it. And what it seems to be is that when these people come here, we have vets in this country that are dying and having their benefits cut off, and they're the ones that should be taken care of first. We have border patrols and ICE that are told to stand down, and they're actually completing the smuggling process, which makes no sense to me whatsoever. So we have these kids that are coming in here, and we have gang members as well. Anybody that's 31 years old or under is considered a child by these standards, which makes no sense to anybody. But these kids are going to be in schools with your children, and they've had tuberculosis. Some of them have had H1N1. That's what we're looking at. And it could possibly be used to collapse the economy. And I think that's what nobody hates the children. We don't want them here. But that's, I think, the main issue is there's a larger agenda here. If there wasn't, the borders would be closed.
Artie, thanks so much for your call. Fermin, Artie says it's not hate. It's not race. It's about real concerns over the economy, health, and other things. How do you see it?
I think that deporting children won't solve anything. Some have advocated for mass deportations. But, you know, in effect, if we deport these children, they'll likely face gang violence, poverty back in their home countries. And we essentially are giving them a death sentence by doing that, by simply sending them back into harm's way. And that's not the American way. We can do better than that.
John?
I want to now bring in – let me just Jose for a moment, or Alan. I'm not sure who that was.
That's Jose.
Okay. I want to bring in Claudia Valenzuela. Her parents came to the U.S. from Guatemala. She's Associate Director of Litigation for the National Immigrant Justice Center. She represents non-citizens before the Department of Homeland Security, the Executive Office for Immigration Review, and the federal courts. Hello, Claudia.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Claudia, I don't know if you heard Artie, the previous call, but I want to put the same issues that he placed on the table in front of you. He says it is not racism, it's not hatred, it's not anti-Latino sentiment, that what is arousing emotion within the United States is real bread-and-butter concerns about the economy, health, and so on. What do you think?
Well, I certainly think those are legitimate concerns. I wouldn't downplay them whatsoever. I think it, from my perspective and from working with some of the children who are arriving and adults as well, I think there are many misconceptions around this population and in terms of some of the messaging that that plays into some of the fears, I think, in terms of, you know, the battle for resources or the needs of citizens in the United States. I think that Mr. Cardenas raised an excellent point in my view about how U.S. Policy has influenced the American region for years, and we cannot ignore that our own policy have contributed to the push factors and why individuals are coming to the United States. And second, we are and we repeatedly say we are a nation that believes in the rule of law, and we have statutes and laws on the books that I think as all Americans, we should be very concerned about seeing them implemented and followed. And I think that one of the hallmarks of our rule of law is a notion and the concept of asylum. And we're living in a world, in a day and age, where this concept is greatly in flux. And what constitutes a basis for asylum, what constitutes a refugee? I'm certainly not saying that every child or adult that arrives at our border would qualify or constitute a refugee. But I think that we need to start looking at that, at the reasons for what's happening on the other side of the border as well as what's happening on our side of the border. I don't think that we can see them separately in this day and age. And I think that we have to view them against the context of the laws that we have enacted as a nation.
Claudia, speaking of those laws, sure. Jose was questioning whether or not that 2008 law targeted at human trafficking had actually contributed to this problem. Do you question that, or do you think that that's clear?
I don't believe that any single law has contributed to this problem. One of the things I think about this debate is it's been unfortunately very short-sighted, and we have this historical memory loss because we have had some pretty tough group of laws on the books for quite some time, dating back to the Clinton administration. You know, the group of laws that were passed in 1996 that essentially part of that group of laws called for people to be just essentially deported without any kind of hearing before any kind of neutral judge or body if you were caught at the border. And I think the 2008 law, what it tried to do was sort of bring back a little bit of due process for individuals who are detained or apprehended at the border, who have real fears and legitimate defenses to their deportation and should have a day in court. And I think most Americans would agree that we should give due process and give
should
a day in court.
Should give due process. Jose, a moment ago, you wanted to jump in. Go right ahead.
Yes, I think that the overriding imperative for the Obama administration is gaining control of the border. I think that the American people expect and frankly deserve nothing less. Unfortunately, that will involve deportations in order to gain control of the situation. And they're necessary.
And they have been doing a significant amount of deportations, have they not?
In response to the present crisis, I believe there's been one plane load that has gone back to Honduras.
Oh, right. I was talking more broadly. Yeah.
Yes, sir. But for two reasons. One is border security issues. At the top of the program, you spoke with Alan about the need for the National Guard. What's happening, John, is that border agents are being diverted from their normal activity of preventing bad people from crossing the border into the United States, people who want to do us harm. So as long as border agents are being distracted from that activity, there's a security vulnerability on our border. And I would say that we need to gain control of the border and stop the flow of people for humanitarian reasons. The real humanitarian crisis is not so much what's happening on our border right now, but what happens on that 1,000-mile trip that Fermin took to get to the United States. What happens to women and children on those trips? They're preyed upon by thieves, by sexual predators. That is what's going on right now.
Very important points, no doubt about it. I do want to get to some more of our callers. Laura is on the line from Des Moines, Iowa. Laura, welcome to the show. What's your question or comment?
Hi. Yeah, hi. Thanks, John. Well, I just wanted to mention that you know, in Iowa, our Governor Branstad has openly come out and said that he doesn't want to have anything to do with bringing any of these children to the state of Iowa, which is so different from our previous governor, who helped bring just hundreds of Laotians here back during the Vietnam War. And what's interesting is in the paper today, the Register, apparently some people have surpassed that request of his not to bring anything here, anybody here, and they have 133 kids here now. So I think on some levels we've got people in communities statewide, citywide, that are trying to do some things. The other point is Obama can't really do anything if he doesn't have any money. Like one of your guests said, if all of our resources are being diverted to try to help these children get situated, then we're left at a loss with, you know, all the other people that are trying to come in. So I think it's important for people to let their Congress people know that they need to go ahead and release this money so that we can help get this problem situated. And one more thing, the gentleman who called the first part of the hour talking about kids with tuberculosis and things, well, there's people in America who don't immunize their children. Our VA issue is because of cuts that we have done to our own selves. So those are just disingenuous arguments right there.
Laura, thanks so much for your call. Alan Gomez, as somebody covering the story, I wonder what you see from state-level political reactions as compared to national. I note, for example, that Martin O'Malley, the governor of Maryland, has criticized the president for not being humane enough, but then the White House leaked some information suggesting that the governor said, oh, don't send kids to this particular place in my state.
Yeah, that's been one of the most interesting things to see in these last few weeks. I think initially, when we were seeing protests like the one you aired earlier from California, when we were seeing protests in Arizona and in as far away as places like Michigan, a lot of politicians were sort of fighting back the idea of having kids coming into their state. It was almost like as the Department of Health and Human Services, which is in charge of placing these kids and finding enough beds for them around the country, as every time like it would be uncovered that they were looking at a site, it was almost like a national security leak. People were reacting very angrily and worried about these people coming into their cities. But in these just in the last few days, there's been some more, mostly mayors that have been kind of stepping up. I spoke with the Syracuse mayor, Stephanie Miner, just last week, and she pretty much just let the feds know, hey, bring them over here. It's okay. The Milwaukee mayor had local officials get together to identify their own places that they could use to bring in some of these kids.
Do you see a difference, Alan, between red state and blue state reactions?
It hasn't been that, you know, it hasn't been that clear cut. And I think when it comes to immigration, everything usually gets a little bit muddled when it comes to that. It hasn't been that simple. It's just, you know, Governor Chris Christie in New Jersey at least opened up the idea to bring in some kids into his state. So that's one example of a pretty hard Republican there kind of allowing for some of that to come in.
Alan Gomez, Jose Cardenas, Fermin Vasquez, Claudia Valenzuela, stay right there. We're talking to Latinos in the United States about what the American response to the surge of unaccompanied minors from Central America should be. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking to Latinos in America about what the U.S. response to the surge in unaccompanied minors across the borders should be. I want to start off this next round of discussion with a clip from President Obama delivered on the 4th of July about the role immigrants play in America.
The basic idea of welcoming immigrants to our shores is central to our way of life. It is in our DNA. We believe our diversity, our differences, when joined together by a common set of ideals, makes us stronger, makes us more creative, makes us different. From all these different strands, we make something new here in America.
Fermin Vasquez, in July 2014, how well is America living up to that description?
I think in President Obama is right in making the argument that many immigrants who come here, like myself, like my mom, like millions who have come here, make this country stronger. They open up businesses. They pay their taxes. They are hiring people. And I think that's a great thing. I think we should have more positive stories in the media around the contributions that immigrants make to this country. Too often we only hear the negative side of, you know, somebody's doing something bad, but in every corner of our country, we can find an immigrant that's living up to the American standards.
Fermin, let's set aside good and bad for a second and talk about what is really behind some of this flow. And I'm interested, as somebody who's made the journey yourself, how much of the flow and the increase we're seeing now is people legitimately fleeing oppression, threats, gangs in their home country, and how many is it people who are taking advantage of an opening that they see that might temporarily make it easier for them to get in permanently to the United States?
I can only speak from my experience and what I've seen. I actually went back after graduating college in 2008. I went back to El Salvador, had the opportunity to go. And it was incredible what I saw. I saw some of my childhood friends, and you know, they were doing they didn't have jobs. They didn't really have any opportunities to go to school. They were just getting by. And I actually, I'm from a very small town there. It's called Izalco. And I actually, my mom kind of was fear for my life when I went back, because there was two young people in our small town that were killed while I was there. They were killed by gangs just because they crossed onto another territory nearby. And, you know, it's people there. I felt actually the fear in people of what they were living, you know. And so that's...
But now, Fermin, you just raised two different issues. One was people without jobs and just getting by. The other is the fear of violence. I think many Americans would say, well, we can't afford to simply welcome in everyone who is just getting by somewhere else and would do better here. It's the people in the latter category that are the ones that they think are that the United States is obliged to embrace and protect.
I would agree with that. I think, we're not, this is not, what's happening right now, it's not an immigration crisis, it's a refugee crisis, and we should be open to welcoming these kids and making sure that, they become productive members of society.
I want to go to a comment we got from a listener on Facebook, and I'm going to direct this to Jose since he raised this issue. This is AC writes on Facebook, "What are the leaders in the countries of origin saying about this? Why isn't the whole world shaming them? Why does this all have to be about immigration at all? This is a human tragedy, and I don't understand how those leaders can hold their heads up. Who wants to invest in those countries? They obviously can't lead themselves at all." Jose?
Wow. Well, that is a... that does raise a very important point. It's just not the present governments of Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. Leaving the history of U.S. involvement in the region aside for a moment, I do believe that countries in the region have become too comfortable with the idea of exporting their people. And they see it as a safety valve for internal discontent, internal dissension. They frankly rely on their citizens leaving for the United States. And that's no way to run a country in the 21st century. You're exporting much of your human capital. So it is not only the fault of governments, but also of local elites, economic elites, political elites, that have failed to build inclusive economies in these countries that give opportunity to the working poor and as much as a middle class exists. So they are indeed as culpable as anybody for failing to create the conditions and exercising the tough political will that is necessary to break up vested interests in those countries and create more inclusive societies that bring more economic opportunity to their citizens.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Gabriel is on the line from Watertown, Massachusetts. Gabriel, welcome to the show. Go right ahead.
Thank you, John. Thank you for taking my call. I work for the American Friends Service Committee, and we have close to a century of working with migrant communities in the United States and also throughout the world fleeing violence and wars. So what I would like to point out is something that's completely missing in this entire discussion, not necessarily in your program, but in the discussion in the halls of Congress and et cetera and major media outlets, and that is, what is our moral and political responsibility for these children? And we have to remember that the first wave of migrants from Central America came in the 1980s during the Ronald Reagan regional wars in Central America, in which, if I need to remind you, 75,000 civilians were killed in El Salvador, 60,000 were killed in Nicaragua, and 200,000 were killed in Guatemala since this government, the United States, overthrew a democratically elected government in 1954. So we need to put that in context. You cannot arm death squads in, let's say, Honduras and El Salvador and then stop it and think that the violence is going to go away. These are consequences of the policies of the United States from the 1980s. Furthermore, in the 1990s, we had the CAFTA, the Central America Free Trade Agreement, which allowed subsidized agricultural products from the United States to flood the Central American markets, therefore displacing small producers and not being able to compete in this new economy. So what do people do when you have massive labor displacement? You migrate. You migrate to where the jobs are. And unfortunately, that happens to be in the fields and low-wage services in the United States.
Gabriel, thanks so much for your call. I want to get to Jose.
I disagree completely.
Has been a policymaker. Gabriel says, Reagan administration in the 1980s, Clinton administration in the 1990s, both contributed to what's happening now. Your response?
I disagree completely. I think that certainly there are people out there with certainly want to grind their ideological axe about the 1980s, about free trade agreements, et cetera, et cetera. I think that where the U.S. is has a very real responsibility in creating the crisis on our border today is our consumption of illegal narcotics. That is the main fuel for the criminality, the gang activity, and the insecurity problem in Central America. It is Americans' consumption of illicit drugs that is fueling the insecurity in Central America.
Claudia, do you agree with Jose that Gabriel was off base in blaming past U.S. policy on trade and security?
I have to say I slightly disagree with him and agree with Gabriel in that we just cannot deny that the historical policies of the United States have influenced the state of the economy and social and other infrastructures in the American region. I think that it's unfortunately something that we do not factor in enough into some of our immigration policies and decision making. And I would say it would be unfortunate to sort of continue to confuse the conversation between what's happening at the border at present and the border, you know, crisis with the overall discussion about what should our immigration policy and laws look like. I think that Fermin rightly points out.
Maybe because it's been pretty clear that that's not changing.
Well, and Fermin rightly points out, I think, that what's happening on the border is a humanitarian crisis. And certainly it can be tied to some of our immigration policies or the state of immigration law at present. But it's really a separate kind of phenomenon that I think that we are kind of as an taking off with, and sort of it's clouding our judgment, I believe, in terms of what should we do for long-term, sound, common-sense policies in the future, both in the immigration realm but also in other areas such as economic policy or foreign policy. I think that, you know, the border crisis itself, as it's being called, and the surge of children is certainly something that, you know, is something that we need to pay attention to. But there are millions of individuals living in the United States, working, contributing to society, positive members who are living in the shadows because, unfortunately, our Congress won't act. And
no,
I think
no
that
doubt about it. Let's go back to the phones. We've got a call on the line from Norman, Oklahoma. Hu Shang is on the line. Welcome to the show. Hu Shang, are you an immigrant yourself, and what's your question?
Yes, John. Hello. Hello to your guests. If you don't take anything away from what I say, please read the article in the last Sunday New York Times written by Sonia Nazario, and it's called The Children of the Drug Wars. I think that is the most important thing to remember. I came to the United States when I was 18, 1977. Hostages were taken. All of a sudden, I, who was in love and am still in love with the United States, fell into that vortex of President Carter deporting all the students, trying to get back or trying to release the hostages. Anyways, lots of headache, lots of dealing with immigration, and I was 18, 19 at the time, so I sympathize with all these kids who come here because, just like a person who is inside a building that's on fire, their last hope is to just jump out of the window. I feel like that's what they're doing. And to my good Americans, don't shut the doors on them. If you're a border patrol, do your job professionally. I was stopped in Las Cruces 32 years ago by two border patrols. Both of them were professional. One of them was kind. I remember him. So do your job, but just be kind, because that's the first and last impression you leave on this kid. And please read the article. I think everybody will benefit from it. It's the author has written a book. It's called Enrique's Journey.
Thank you so much for your call. I appreciate it. Alan Gomez, that call came from Norman, Oklahoma. You can hear stories like that everywhere in the United States these days.
Absolutely. I mean, this is, I think one of the things that's kind of driving this so much is that, you know, it's been 20 years, 20, 30 years of just this incredible growth, specifically from Central and South America throughout the United States. So communities that just were not accustomed to having to deal with this issue of just thinking that it's just a problem down in the border states or something to deal with down along the border states. Are now being confronted by this. And, you know,
We've heard on the show so far, not, you know, Fermín's in California. Everybody knows California has a lot of immigrants, but we've heard from Massachusetts, from the state of Iowa, from the state of Oklahoma, which suggests to me that even if the Congress is gridlocked for now, it can't stay gridlocked forever because this problem is so, and this issue is so pervasive in American society, don't you think?
I mean, you would think, right? And that's been one of the frustrating things about throughout this entire period. Everything that we're talking about today, I mean, not to say that if Congress passed an immigration bill tomorrow that all of a sudden these kids that are coming from Central America would suddenly halt. But there are so many issues. I mean, when we talk about, you know, the difficulty of getting into this country and finding a visa, immigration reform can help sort of reform the legal immigration system to possibly get some more of those workers in here. When we look at changes to border security, to tightening the ability of undocumented immigrants to find jobs in the United States, I mean, we can just run down such a long list of issues that are broken with our immigration system that require some kind of change, and yet there's been no action in Congress on immigration for over a year since the Senate passed its version of an immigration bill.
Plenty of room for more legislative action and for more shows on this topic. Alan Gomez, immigration reporter for USA Today, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Jose Cardenas, associate at the consulting firm Vision Americas, thank you.
Thank you, John.
Claudia Valenzuela, associate director of litigation for the National Immigrant Justice Center, thanks.
Thanks to you, John.
And Fermin Vasquez, communication specialist at Community Coalition in South LA. Good luck with your application to become a U.S. citizen.
Thank you, John.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook, at On Point Radio. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.